Hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
And Peter Salmon.
Thanks for joining me, guys. I know Peter's back from vacation. Tim's talking about going on vacation. It's that time of year. So managed to get a good crossover, I guess. End Credits is the local movie show for local movie fans here on CFRU, and you can hear us here in our temporary home for the summer Thursdays at 10 a.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new action, horror, western fantasy based on the Stephen King novel series, The Dark Tower. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we are going to tackle some of the movie news and from the past week, including the lineup for the Toronto International Film Festival. It's a little over a month till the festival begins, and we'll look at some of the films and what they say about the current state of TIFF. And then we will look at the trailer for the Death Wish trailer, the Eli Roth remake of the original 1974 film. It's super glossy, but we'll talk about the themes and whether or not Roth's style makes it all the more disturbing. And first of all, though, HBO, the famous HBO, has become the latest Hollywood victim of hacking. And it has studios and the networks on edge, given, you know, what happened with things like the Sony hack in 2014. That was also the same year as the famous iPhone celebrity hack. Then there was Orange is the New Black. The episodes were hacked for Orange is the New Black. I think it was last year that happened. So, Peter, you live on the internet.
Yeah, I do. I love that internet. My generation does.
So, you know, it's... kind of, you know, this is obviously big business we're talking about, but I mean, it's also kind of scary because this isn't just, we can look at it and go, oh, you know, rich Hollywood jerks, but, you know, this is also people's livelihoods, careers, jobs that, you know, really kind of unscrupulous people are laying bare.
Yeah, I really don't see a point of it too, because I don't think they released any full episodes of Game of Thrones or anything like that. So, mm-hmm. If they did that, the justification would be there is some people who, especially my age, students, things like that, that can't afford to pay for HBO, so then they could watch Game of Thrones because everyone's addicted.
It's the most pirated show in the world.
It is the most pirated show in the world and one of the most watched. But other than that, they didn't do that. And even with that, I'm not okay with that. I think you should always watch it live, new episodes. I didn't even check if you could watch any episodes because I don't want to do that. I don't want to ruin anything. It's the equivalent of on a Christmas, if you know where your parents hide the gifts and you go and you find where they are, and then on Christmas you're just disappointed. Yeah. So that's what would happen. It would just ruin the Game of Thrones episodes for me. Or I was more worried if they had done it later this year and they revealed an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, because it's that what I'm super excited for, and Larry David would have lost it if that happened.
Yeah, there's big spoilers in Curb Your Enthusiasm about the Night King and all that. Yeah.
About him offending somebody.
That's
and,
right.
And all being resolved at the end.
Uncomfortably resolved, I think is the point. But yeah, there hasn't been any episodes released. I think they released episodes of Ballers and Room 104, at least one of those shows I've
heard of.
I'm
actually looking forward to Room 104. It's the Duplass boys, and they're awesome.
Right.
Ballers is... is Ballers.
Ballers is Ballers.
It's fun to watch The Rock, but other than that.
Tim, your thoughts?
Well, I think obviously the hackers are to blame, but I also think people who download the material, like you were just talking about, like there's no market for it if people aren't illegally downloading the material.
Sure enough, yeah.
So it comes down to, okay, if people are going to steal, are you going to accept the stolen goods? And I think it's tough to say, because in today's generation, you want to be on the internet, you want to see all this material, and you don't really think of it as stolen or, you know, anything nefarious going on, because that's the way you've grown up. But it's kind of like devalued a lot in the entertainment industry when you look at music and you look at movies and TV shows now. It's kind of to the point where, okay, I can just torrent this. I can just, for free, I just want to watch this, you know? And it's almost like, okay, this is for the masses. There's nobody involved in the creation of it, really. It's just, I want to be able to discuss this with my friends and be ahead of the game. And I think that's where we run into problems. And then how are people, you know, making money off? Because people need money to keep going. And in the music industry, it's one thing because you have like live concerts and stuff where you can get those revenue streams. But when it comes to TV and film, sometimes, especially actually the smaller shows, unlike Game of Thrones, the ones that are maybe just trying to get out there, it's their right. first season. If they're downloaded illegally, it could end up killing those shows.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
That's a great point because, you know, we say Game of Thrones is the most pirated show in the world, but still like 30 million people watch it, mm-hmm. Or at least watch the season premiere. I think that's how many people watch the first episode of season 7. So, you know, although Paul is right, there are, you know, still sections of... Did I call you by your father's name, by the way?
Paul?
Yeah.
Did you call me Paul?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Is that your dad's name?
Yeah, Paul.
His dad's a well-known UFG film professor, so...
Okay.
That's how I know about this film.
But Peter made a point that there are people out there who have limited means but still want to be part of the conversation, and they do partake, or just want to stick it to the man in this case being HBO. But... I do wonder if, you know, the getting the Game of Thrones episodes was the point. Getting any Game of Thrones information was the point. Certainly wasn't the point in the case of the Sony hacks, which seemed to be purely about embarrassing the
Sony.
Studio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's been differing reports about how much information was taken. Like the 1.5 terabytes was initially reported.
Which is a lot, because a lot of it's just scripts and paper and things like that. So that's
right. And it's seven times bigger than the Sony hack, which was 200 gigabytes, because that was mostly emails.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was 1.5 terabytes, I would be assume there would be some kind of digital media attached mm-hmm. to that, like episodes. But actually, they're saying it was only maybe 300 gigabytes stolen, so...
Mm-hmm. Which isn't that much.
I think a
motive often is to embarrass people as well. Like, if you can get a Sony executive saying something bad about George Clooney or something, then you're like, wow, this is the jackpot. And, like, the social media age, you'll be like, okay, I'm going to share this on Twitter, what I found out that the CEO of Sony said about Angelina Jolie or something like that.
Things like Jennifer Lawrence trying to get, you know, equal copay to male co-stars for American Hustle, which was a thing. Concussion mm-hmm. and its relationship to the NFL, that, you know, that executives were trying to re-edit it in such a way that it wasn't as embarrassing to the NFL, or mm-hmm. Something like some development exec coming up with the idea, hey, let's cross over Men in Black and 21 Jump Street and make 21 Men in Black Street or something. The point of that was just to, and it, you know, there's still, I don't think it's 100% been solved who was behind it, although the inference was that it was North Korean or a North Korean sponsor because of the interview.
Two of the hacks were apparently different, though.
Yeah.
The first one and then the one the day after were totally different people.
That's true, too. The point of that is, was just kind of pure embarrassing people. And I don't think the point of this has been yet revealed. There was a promised info dump on Sunday, which I don't think has yet materialized.
Mm-hmm. It was more a dump. They just wanted to show how... They just wanted to insult HBO.
Yeah.
They just wanted to screw over HBO. It's such mm-hmm. a major TV channel that you have to pay for, right? So the hackers are probably against that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Goes against what most hackers believe in.
Yeah.
Right.
And I read further about it, and a lot of the folders that they hacked into were like... 2012 IT help desk stuff. It was like how to reinstall Windows on your machine and stuff like that. So it's like they're not going to be able to embarrass people with that, I don't think. So it was just sort of a bunch of garbage.
Yeah. Ask an average IT person some of the questions they get on a daily basis. And there's nothing embarrassing about how the troubles people have that require IT help. Speaking of embarrassing, or maybe not, I mean, it depends on your point of view, but the Toronto International Film Festival started releasing its slate of movies this year, and they announced the opening night one. It's Borg McEnroe, which is about the rivalry between the
Borg
Swedish...
Borg and McEnroe.
between Borg and McEnroe. I was trying to contextualize it. The tennis, in case people don't know their tennis history, I mean, wouldn't surprise me if people didn't know their tennis history.
So cyborgs playing John McEnroe?
Well, you know what? I bet there are a lot of people Peter's age who recognize John McEnroe from his various cameo appearances, like being in Adam Sandler movies. I'm sure there's more people who know John McEnroe from like the 5 minutes he was in Mr. Deeds than the fact he was a tennis player.
I've seen every Adam Sandler film, but I have no memory of him because I probably didn't know he was a tennis player when I watched them.
There you
but
go.
I'm going to rewatch them now.
You're like, why is this guy carrying around a tennis racket?
But I think it's a vastly improved choice over last year's opening film, Magnificent Seven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a remake of a remake.
Yeah, a remake of a remake of a mm-hmm. Japanese film classic. But this used to be an automatic pick for Canadian film. Mm-hmm. You know, this used to be to show off Canadian cinema. This is a huge festival, and we want to show some hometown pride, presumably, but that seems to have gone out the window.
Because it's gotten bigger, more major.
Well, yeah, sure.
It's all about the commerciality of the whole enterprise now, right? You can see with a lot of this, the decisions they've made this year, but like Borg McEnroe, I don't know how big a draw that would be, actually, but it looks like a good movie from what I've seen. It's got Shia LaBeouf playing McEnroe, which mm-hmm. is pretty crazy.
It's great but, casting. Yeah.
But it seems like they've kind of, they're just going for what's commercial, what's going to create the most buzz, what has Academy Award potential, mm-hmm. and they're really, and they said they're doing this to tighten the films, but basically it's just to make it as commercial as possible, I think.
Yeah, they got rid of two, if you don't know, the Toronto International Film Festival is kind of separated into various programs. You got Midnight Madness, you have the special presentations, and they got rid of two, which was the Vanguard mm-hmm. and the City to City, which is like probably the two programs you're most likely to see things you're not going to be able to see at your movie theater months later or on Netflix at some point or even in your art house cinema.
Yeah, exactly. Like Vanguard would have more experimental films and City to City, I actually saw something last year. There is a Nigerian film. I would probably never would have seen the film. Mm-hmm. And there's a Q&A with the director and it was great. I got to look into the culture, and they're actually from an affluent background in Nigeria, so it was interesting seeing that depicted. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's gone because the City to City is gone now too, right? So it'd be interesting to see what are they showing there that's not going to have like a mass release, or you know? Because I remember I saw a movie there a couple years ago, and it was called The Club. It was a foreign film about a bunch of priests who had like abused children, and they live alone on an island. Mm-hmm. And it, I forget the director, but it was a foreign film. And I remember there was an actual priest in line with me, and I started talking to him, and he said, "Oh, I came to see this specifically because this is an interesting movie. I want to learn more about how they depict the priests in this movie." Right. And I got talking to him, and he said, "I come to TIFF every now and then. Just see movies I can't see anywhere else." He's right. Like, he said, "I'm not going to go see The Martian because I know it's going to be out in a couple months from now, right?"
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of losing that side of the festival, I think, the more independent side.
Yeah, it's currently like a lot of the TIFF films, like just right after, a week after, whatever, it'll be in like, you know, Galaxy Cinemas or just mm-hmm. theaters in general, like Darren Aronofsky's upcoming one, Mother. It's going to... When I saw The Dark Tower, there was a trailer for it, so it's going to be in Galaxy Cinemas and not too long after TIFF. So like you guys were saying, it is becoming a lot more major. I'm okay with that just in the sense that Toronto gets to see a lot more celebrities. It's a lot more come down. And
You're one of those.
I guess, yeah. I'm a Canada fan.
What are they wearing on the red carpet kind of thing?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like for Dallas Buyers Club, it was cool to see McConaughey just chilling in Toronto.
Yeah, I mean, the selection of Mother, I wonder how much of that has to do with it, whether it's A, it's Aronofsky, or B, because if we have this, then Jennifer Lawrence will totally come.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of that kind of stuff, but, you know, I remember going to TIFF press screenings, and this was kind of years ago, but, you know, seeing, like, all the Entertainment Tonight Canada people there and all the E-Talk people there, and it's like, you're only there to, you know, because you have to ask them questions on the red carpet, and it's, you know, covering cinema and talking about cinema is secondary, if not tertiary. But the thing I found interesting is there's been a lot of discussion about the Platform program, which was apparently kind of like a... Maybe you can correct me, Tim, but it seems like it's kind of a more prestige level, kind of, you know, inside baseball level, where you have filmmakers evaluating and awarding prizes to films of a certain caliber, you know, maybe trying to capture some of that vanguard spirit. And oddly enough, this is where Jackie came out of, the Natalie Portman, Jackie Kennedy biopic, and Moonlight, Best Picture winner, Moonlight. And there seems to be a lot of debate about this platform program, and now it's kind of being commercialized. This was supposed to be the artistic, the new artistic enterprise launched by TIFF a couple of years ago, and now it's there's like, oh, we can launch Oscar winners out of this. It's not just the People's Choice Award anymore that launches, you know, Slumdog, La La Land, all those movies. Now they've sort of accidentally stumbled upon you know, turning this into another venue for establishing TIFF dominance, if you will, at the Oscars.
They'll still have some more short films and documentaries and things of a more indie nature. So I think hopefully they always have that. It's just they won't be shown at the major TIFF theater.
No. They won't. Yeah, you'll have to schlep it up to Scotiabank or
the Bloor or something.
Or go into like the third or fourth floor of the TIFF light box, not on the cool second floor.
Which is too bad.
Yeah.
Which is too bad.
And all that being said, one of the worst movies I've ever seen was an independent film at TIFF. It was a French film. And I remember Piers Handling, who was in charge, he introduced it at Scotiabank Theater. And it was really bad. I know a lot of people were walking out. I stuck with it, but it just made no sense at all. And in the program, they're saying, oh, this is like a combination of, forget who they're comparing it to, like David Lynch and stuff. And I'm like, not really.
You know? Was it even close?
No. So there's like sometimes hype like that, but at least I discovered something. I tried something new, right?
Right.
I wouldn't have gone to that film.
It's risky, otherwise, but you could end up seeing the best one you've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, when Candace and I did the Canada Day show, I talked about Modra, which was a movie I saw at TIFF. It was a small Canadian independent movie, probably made for the average catering budget of a day on the Dark Tower. And it was such a wonderful movie. It was so engrossing, so affecting. But that's what you go to film festivals to see. It's like, you're right, you can go see The Martian next week. Yeah. You can go see Borg McEnroe, The Disaster Artist, is playing. We talked about that movie a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. That's going to be coming out in December. Mm-hmm. You know, you can catch this stuff anywhere. And I understand where this is kind of coming from on TIFF's part, because there's more competition with Venice, the Venice Film Festival, Telluride, New York Film Festival, all these major festivals kind of taking place within the same sort of month period. And they're trying to stay relevant.
South by Southwest is on at the same time, and it's playing a lot of better things, in my opinion. If I could, I'd go see that, not TIFF. No offense to Toronto.
I've heard about Telluride. I've heard from like American friends. They're like, they're showing a lot of this stuff before.
Yeah.
They showed at TIFF. I think it's like a week or two before TIFF, and it just doesn't get as the press. Like even in the States, like TIFF still gets a lot of the press.
It's
like
a good amount.
Considered one of the top three or four festivals in the world, and they're probably just trying to keep that press here, right? But getting the celebrity content.
Yeah.
And go back to your point, Adam, about, you know, the opening film being Canadian. I know they tried to do a couple Canadian films, but they were like the commercial type, like they did Score, the hockey musical, I think the one year.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they did Men in Brooms too, but it's like
More than likely.
These movies that are kind of Canadian, but to a fault almost, you know.
Last year they had a documentary that was all about Nelly Furtado, and that was like the one major Canadian one. It was just Nelly Furtado after Nelly Furtado.
Yeah.
So that was Canadian at least.
Yeah. You know what? I did see Score later on, and I have a certain amount of fondness because it's like so Canada. Yeah. But I see your point though. It's
it's like it's good, but like it's almost like stereotypical Canadian movies is what they were putting in that slot before. So,
I mean, as long as we're not getting Magnificent Seven, which was a movie that came out like 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
Stars Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke, all these Hollywood celebrities. It's a remake of a remake of a Japanese film. And it's, you know, it's just, it's so blah. It's so it's so like what Hollywood is right now, and that's not what you go to a film festival for. I don't think
that's what I don't like about Borg and McEnroe being like the main one. It's a biopic. Like a lot of people have already seen it in real life, you know, and that's becoming like one of the main types of films people seem to like, and they're okay, but like nowadays the only films that get Oscar nominations are biopics, and this TIFF one's a biopic, and I've seen too many of them.
Yeah. And you know, there are a lot of biopics. There's Darkest Tower, Churchill. There's one about Tonya Harding. There's The Battle of the Sexes, another tennis movie. And then there's one about the creator of Wonder Woman as well coming this year.
That'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah, but and you know, but to go to your point, how many people know anything about, you know, the creator of Wonder Woman versus you know tennis movies?
And I think the biopics do well at the Oscars because people can look at footage of that person and say, "Oh, you look exactly like them. You sound exactly like them." So it's all like an unfair advantage just because you've impersonated a person, kind of thing.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's a movie nobody's going to be talking about at Oscar time, and we're going to play a little bit of clip from the trailer for Death Wish. So let's listen to this just for a sec.
I love my family. But when they needed me most.
911, what is your emergency?
There's men, they're breaking into my house. I think they're here.
No.
I failed to protect them.
Dad, where's Mom?
The men who did it are out there.
So there's nothing that you can do? Is that what you're saying?
If a man really wants to protect what's his,
I want to buy a gun.
He has to do it for himself.
Yeah, that was a clip from Death Wish. It is the remake of the 1974 film that pretty much ushered in the Taken years of Charles Bronson. If we're looking backwards and comparing him to sort of Liam Neeson, it was sort of the, you know, him being the older action movie figure. There's been a lot. I mean, you heard the first couple of hits of Back in Black by AC/DC right at the end of that clip. And I think that's the point where the trailer loses a lot of people, because if you go back and look at the original Bronson Death Wish, it's almost exploitative. It's almost grindhouse in a way. You know, it's very very much of the time too. This 70s era where crime was on the rise in the United States, urban areas were rampant. You know, there's a lot of talk about American decay, decline of the American Empire, that kind of thing, and you look at this trailer and it's all glossy, it's all slick, and it looks like Bruce Willis, his character, Paul Kearney, after the death of his wife and the brutal attack of his daughter, is having the best time ever getting revenge on the people who have ruined his life.
Yeah. He's not in mourning anymore, and he's just like on a high.
He's past that, yeah.
There's a scene at the end of the trailer where he's talking to, I guess, some sort of counselor or therapist, and she's like, you know, you seem to be doing better. And he's like, yeah, I'm doing a little bit, you know, doing the Bruce Willis thing. And she's like, well, whatever you're doing, keep it up. And he's like, oh, I will. And I don't know if Eli Roth actually said that, you know, people are going to have to wait and see the context of the film. But the context of what we know about the story in the trailer is, it's wicked awesome to be a vigilante and kill people indiscriminately. And you will feel better killing the people who hurt you. And I'm not sure that's the right message right now, especially with a white protagonist and a largely minority.
Yeah, that's
true. It takes place in Chicago too, right? So, like, with all the crime problems there, they're exploiting that, right?
But it's not white people that are suffering. And in terms of the crime in Chicago right now, it is minority neighborhoods. It's minority. It's minority perpetrators, but it's also minority victims.
Yeah, Chi-Town's just dealing with a lot. And everyone should see Chi-Raq, the film. It's all about Chicago, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great one. Recent Spike Lee movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just I won't go so far as some people. There was a piece I read on Forward where it like talked about, you know, Jewish people trying to live vicariously through white supremacists. I might be butchering his allegory there, but I mean that almost goes too far in some of the SJW stuff. But it's there's something about this in 2017 that feels icky to me.
Yeah, it felt icky in the original too, probably. Well, I wasn't around in 74, but I saw it after the fact, the Charles Bronson one, and it's just pure exploitation. Like there's a scene where his wife and daughter are like raped and murdered, and it's just so graphic, and it's just like, okay, now he's just gonna take justice on it, and it's just all about like revenge, and the legal system doesn't work, I'm gonna get my own revenge.
I can see what Eli Roth was a huge fan of that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll probably see it just for fun. I haven't seen an Eli Roth film in a long time, and I love the Hostels, Hostel 1 and 2. They're messed up. It's gory, but they're enjoyable, and I haven't seen Bruce Willis in anything recently either that I can think of.
You know what? He hasn't been on the big screen since 2013.
Really?
But he's been like cranking out these direct-to-DVD stuff, and you can find some of it on Netflix. But it's just... You know, and Eli Roth actually said that this was going to be like the thing that like relaunches him and you know, puts him back on the map again. And, if that happens, I'm glad for Bruce Willis because he does look like he sleeps, walks through just about everything these days. I think the last time I saw him engage was Looper. And I think that's because he was actually doing something more challenging than the average.
Right.
But... Yeah, it's I can't get over the fact that, you know, I understand the story, I understand the themes, and you're right about the original Death Wish. It is exploitative in a very unsettling way. But there was also the time to up to it as well, the timing of it, and, and people did feel powerless.
Yeah.
The crime was rising. We're seeing the exact opposite right now. It's like Chicago is one of the outliers where there is a lot of rampant violent crime, but for the most part, violent crime is going down.
Yeah, and the original movie wasn't jokey like in the trailer, like you're saying. It's all like,
it had no comedy in it. It wasn't very comedic.
No. Not at all.
It was very straight.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a scene in the trailer where he's like, I guess he's at a gun store and there's like this attractive girl behind the counter and she's like, you're cocked and locked. And he's like, oh, yeah. And it's...
my wife and daughter are dead, but I'm cocked and locked. I'm ready to take it on now.
If he did it straight, okay. I think there's some... what I will say about there could have been something powerful to that film.
Yeah,
you know, about, you know, sort of exploiting, you know, foreign trips and, you know, ugly Americanism. That could have all been made pretty potent statements in that movie. But then he goes straight for the blood and straight for the guts and straight for the nudity. And if that's what you're going to do with Death Wish, okay, but I don't think that's where we want to be in 2017.
No, he should have released this a couple years ago, like 5 years ago, or maybe at some point in the future. It's just, it's a really awful time for it.
Yeah.
But it'll be good to see Bruce Willis on the screen again.
I don't disagree, and I would rather see him in this than Die Hard 6. I'll say that. Actually, come to think of it, he did have a cameo in Split.
Oh.
So I won't spoil this, because it's kind of a spoiler. I think it's mostly out there, but go check out Split because that's actually a good movie to watch, unlike Death Wish. But we'll see.
Are you sure Bruce Willis isn't just chilling, not wanting to be in major films?
Well, why is he doing all this direct-to-DVD stuff then?
I guess it's just Vin Diesel and, like, Dwayne The Rock and Fast and Furious are so big. And Bruce Willis is, like, he's even stronger than them. And he's better in action films and things. So I don't see why he's having trouble becoming as famous as he used to be.
You don't think that... I do want to kind of go to the musical break, but open this door. But you don't think that if they offered Bruce Willis a role in the Fast and Furious movie that he wouldn't take it?
Oh, yeah, he'd take it in a second.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be like, I don't know, if he like could be like Dominic Toretto's long-lost uncle or something. You know, but I think the door is open. I think he would do it. I think there is a lot of fondness for Bruce Willis. And it's an interesting question about why he's doing all this schlock and why it seems like he's sleepwalking and doing things like Red Dew. But anyway, maybe, you know, if you watch Split and it sets up a future project, he might, you know... Maybe we'll get some of the old Bruce back. Anyway, we're going to take a musical break. And for this week, I have this little ditty from a group called Local Natives. And this is from their 2016 album, Sunlit Youth. Not Sonic Youth, Sunlit Youth. and it is called Dark Days. And we'll be back with a review of The Dark Tower. After this, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Hey! a shortcut through a hedge maze.
Get away, you little!
No, go easy on the wee one. His father's gonna go crazy and chop them all into haggis.
What's haggis?
Boy, you read my thoughts. You've got the shinning.
You mean shining.
Shh! You wanna get sued? Now look, boy. If your dad goes gaga, you just use that shin of yours to call me and I'll come a-running. But don't be reading my mind between 4 and 5. That's Willie's time.
That was not a clip from The Dark Tower, but I just couldn't resist. This is the real clip from The Dark Tower.
Who are you?
It's you. You're a gunslinger, right?
There are no gunslingers. Not anymore.
Why does the man in black want to destroy the tower?
The tower protects both our worlds. If it falls, hell will be unleashed.
He's like the devil, isn't he?
No, he's worse.
You can't stop what's coming. Death always wins.
Yeah, that was the clip from The Dark Tower. It stars Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey. Tom Taylor, Catherine Winnick, Jackie Earle Haley, Claudia Kim, and Dennis Haysbert. It was directed by Nicolas Arcel, who people may recognize from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original one starring Naomi Rapace, not the remake starring Rooney Mara, which was David Finkner. So this was based on the Stephen King novel series. I think we were discussing this before the show. None of us read the source material. Which is a shame. I wouldn't mind that point of view because I just scanning online, seeing people's reactions and message boards and things. It seems like fans of the book are fans of the movie. But let's start with the person I think who liked it the most of the three of us, which is Tim.
Yeah.
So what about Dark Tower appealed to you?
Well, I enjoyed it. It was quite entertaining. And I think if you don't like this film, if you don't like this film, you've probably forgotten your father's face. Well, that was repeated throughout. That was a mantra throughout.
Yeah.
So there were some cliches and mantras, but I kind of rolled with it, and I enjoyed a lot of the film. And I thought Matthew McConaughey, he can do no wrong for me in a lot of his movies.
Same here.
He's got that presence, and I think he could be a villain in other movies as well. He was so good as just being like pure evil, the Walter O'Dim Man in Black character. I really liked when he was on the screen. You know, his dialogue, when you just play snippets of it, it's pretty cheesy. But in the course of the film, I thought he created some tension and some conflict for sure. And Idris Elba was good. He was fine. But he has great screen presence as well. So he doesn't
Absolutely.
Really have to say a lot. And he has that screen presence. And the kid, Jake Chambers, was the character's name? Tom Taylor. Tom Taylor, yeah. He was good as well, which comes back to the whole Stephen King. It's often about adolescent yeah. boys. And I thought he fit perfectly in that mold. There's problems, obviously, with the cliches and the mantras they keep saying. If you don't shoot properly, you've forgotten your father's face over and over again. But other than that, I thought it was...
I shoot with my hand, I shoot with my mind, he shoots with his hand, he's forgotten his father's face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty entertaining. It's kind of funny that I think it's gotten really bad reviews so far, but it's set up for a sequel at the end with him going with the kid going with the gunslinger. And I know there's a series of books. I don't know if they'll make a sequel given maybe the reaction to this one, but kind of set up for that. And I don't know if I would rush out to see it, but I might see it on Netflix or something like that. And I thought this movie was good.
And I don't know if it was a sequel. I think they were trying to lead towards a TV show.
Yeah. Mm. That's the thing.
That might still work.
This has had like a really weird development cycle where it's like it's a movie. No, it's a TV show. No, it's a movie. No, it's a TV show. Now we're doing a movie and now they're doing a TV show or something. And I don't think this is specifically based on one of the books. I think it's like a sequel to the books or something. I mean, this is
a mesh of like all of them put
together. Yeah, it is. What did you think of it?
Oh, me? I actually really liked it too. Like a lot more than I thought. I'm also a huge Matthew McConaughey fan, so that might have been a bit biased. But the cinematography is what surprised me the most. It was really good. It's someone who's always worked with the director, Nicolas Jarcel, Rasmus Vidbeik, and I thought it was really good. The very first shot on top of that mountain was spectacular. It was, at least it was a way better of a shot than I expected for an 18% on Rotten Tomatoes film. That's for sure. And I thought Idris was great. He didn't have many lines, like you said, but his face in every shot was just, he's just so good at, even if he doesn't say a word, he knows how to be a damn good actor. Mm. I thought this character was really good for him, very somber, and that seems to be what he's good at portraying and playing as. And like what you were saying, Tom Taylor, has he been in another film?
I can look it up.
But it was obviously one of his first films, and I was surprised at how good he was. I, based on the reviews, I assumed he was maybe one of the reasons it was so bad, just a young actor not doing a good job. But other than a couple cliches, like classic blockbuster lines, you know, he was good. It was maybe a bit too much of a father theme throughout all of it. Like, it sort of started to feel like Idris Elba was Tom Taylor's dad in the film, and, you know, he added a dad, he had a stepdad, and just maybe too much father in it. But that was the point of the books, too, so it's good that they were able to put that into the films.
He's done some TV work. He was on Legends, I think, which was, what's his face? Sean Bean? That was the head of that show. And he was on The Last Kingdom. And Taboo, which I think is Tom Hardy's show.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, he's
a small amount of things. This was his first big boom.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully. That's the one thing I'm worried about is obviously Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey are going to be fine from here on. But this, his first, they're already totally fine.
They'll be fine.
And,
yeah.
But this is like his first blockbuster, and it's, nobody's going to see it. It got awful reviews. But I hope he's still able to continue on and maybe become even more famous.
Well, I mean, it's usually the child actors who do well you have to worry about later on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any problems with the kid. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problems with Idris Elba. He's someone who should be a huge star, I think.
He's building up to it. He's getting there.
Well, he's building, I think, but he's been around for years.
Yeah.
You know, it should have happened by now. If it happens later, I'm not going to fight it, obviously. But, you know, he's someone who's got, like, real magnetic presence. And Matthew McConaughey, I will say, I read one line from a review, said Matthew McConaughey is like RuPaul playing Clint Eastwood.
Cool. Everyone wants to see that.
I'm not sure who that's the greater insult to, RuPaul or Clint Eastwood.
RuPaul.
But I actually don't think he was as bad as all that. I think he was, I hesitate to say, maybe the best part of it. There was the scene where he's threatening Jake's mom, and he's in their home. Jake lives with his mom, and his background is his father was like a hero fireman who died trying to save people in a fire. And his mom has since remarried to a dick. Every stepfather in the movies is a dick.
Yeah, it's like one classic of those cliches. Classic stepfather. You don't care what happens to him. Kind of.
Classic stepfather is a dick.
Yeah, there's a sprinkle of cliches. Maybe one too many.
But there's a scene where they come home and the man in black is there and he's like wearing an apron and he's making food. And he's like, "Welcome home, everyone." And I burst out laughing. It's not because it was meant for comedy, but, you know, just to see this man who is like, you're told from the beginning of the film is pure evil, and he's just kind of chilling out. And then it goes into a scene where he takes the mom into Jake's room, and he sees like all the various timelines overlapping of the kid drawing all these pictures of the Dark Tower, of the gunslinger, of these hench people who have skin sewn on. And that was a really great scene. But then when he's sort of watching all these things get laid out, and the kid's trying to put together the pieces of this mythology too, you come to the realization, at least I came to the realization, none of this has been explained at all.
No.
None, like, what are these creatures with the skin sewn on them? Yeah. Like, why are they wearing skin?
Yeah.
That was a lot of people's main problems for it. Just not really anything being explained.
Yeah, well, the whole Dark Tower thing. We never go to the Dark Tower. This is like never going to Mordor in Lord of the Rings. It's like everyone talking about having to get the ring to Mordor, and then they get halfway there and like, oh, we'll destroy it here. This is good here. the thing about the different worlds, they go to, I want to call it Middle Earth, but it's not Middle Earth.
That's what I was referring to. I'm not sure what you call it.
But it's another. Yeah, it's this world where it was a pretty advanced level of technology. They have portholes and things, but it's like kind of collapsed. It's like a post-apocalyptic world, but it's never like, why did it fall? Why were all the gunslingers killed? Man in Black, why is he so determined to destroy the Dark Tower? It's like, yeah, he wants to bring hell to all the worlds. And it's like, well, that's great. Why is he wanting to bring hell everywhere? Where do all these minions come from?
But to explain all that would take at least a trilogy, if not more movies, I think.
Oh, way more movies.
Because like that Stephen King, right? He writes, it's so dense, everything. He writes thousands of pages in his stories that it'd be tough in that movie to explain it. So it's almost like they were going more for the action and just, you know, okay, we see these people with the skin masks. Okay, they're bad news. They're coming. They work for Walter O'Dim, the Man in Black. So it's just creating that tension, sort of. You know, it's very rudimentary, but I thought it worked when I watched it. It was like it created the tension. You're worried about the kid and you know.
Yeah, a lot of people's, like, main problems were that there was too many questions left. But for me, like, I know I've mentioned him way too much, but, like, I'm a Lynch fan. People like him. And I like there being a lot of questions. It just gives so much freedom to your imagination.
Right.
And so those actually weren't major problems to me. I'm actually kind of glad that he didn't go so in-depth and try and explain everything in 90 minutes because they wouldn't have been able to.
It could have gotten really boring, too, if he got into, like, a lot of backstory on this stuff because it seemed a little bit cookie-cutter as it was. So then if you go deep into it, it might
disagree, but I think there are ways you could have done it. And I think they spent at least 10 years various parties trying to develop this. At some point, some screenwriter somewhere must have been able to crack this to the point where you can give people enough answers. This is like a 90-minute movie, too. It's super quick. It's like over before you know it, perhaps thankfully in some cases. But there was room that they could have expanded on some things, too, I think. They do have little nods and winks to other Stephen King things, other Stephen King stories, which is part of the Dark Tower mythology. You know, they
like The Shine.
The Shine. Yeah. The Shine. I have huge problems with The Shine in this movie.
The film?
No, not The Shining. The Shine okay, as it's used in this film, because it seems like the Force. The Shine is basically the Force or magic. You know, he's the kid Jake is basically Harry Potter. That's fine. But I think if you go back and even just watch The Shining, that's kind of not the point of The Shining, having the shine. I love the scene in the therapist's office where he just happens to have a picture of the Overlook Hotel on his desk. There's references to insomnia there, which I think that was the sequel to The Shining. But there's also references to It. You know, they make camp in an old theme park, and you can see it's called Pennywise Playground or something, which is, of course, a reference to It, and the references to Crimson King and 1408 and all this great Stephen King lore. And it's like somebody somewhere in the production process understood what this movie was and where it sits in the King lore. But on the screenwriting end, and there were four screenwriters, and a couple of them are actually fairly good screenwriters. And, you know, someone like Jeff Pinker, who's done a lot of great TV work. Akiva Goldsman, who, of course, has done, like, things like Batman and Robin, but he's also done a lot of great films as well. An Academy Award winner, I might add. But it's just, there's things that happen that have no... There's one scene in particular that stood out to me when Walter is on Earth, and he's just kind of, like, walking around, and he sees this little girl talking to her mom, and he, like, pats her on the head, and he's like, oh, there's a good girl, and her eyes go black, and it's like, ooh, something's going to pay off there. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, that was true.
It's something about the way he was playing it. It's like he was playing every bad version of Satan that's ever been on film, and even though, again, as I noted earlier, it was effective, it's just... Yeah, there was...
Kind of remind me of Darth Vader a bit, especially when in their war room there.
Yeah.
The way he was instructing people to go.
That was very Death Star. But again, it's like, how is he like having this like world with touch screens, and then they go to this little village where, you know, people are living in huts, and they have livestock, and they look like Amish people. Yeah. And it's just, you know, I just want a line. I just wanted Jake to ask the question. It's like, wow, like how is there this advanced technology and everyone's living like dirt people? And the gunslinger could have said, well, this happened in 19 dickety whatever. Because there's also where they're in the real world, or Keystone Earth, if you will, where he's at the hospital and they're like, okay, so gunslinger, you have hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis E, which I've never heard of, plus radiation sickness. And it's like, well, how is this guy walking around? Like, what are the powers of the gunslinger then that he's like the Mr. Burns? Like, there was that episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns was discovered to have like every disease and he's able to live like because all the diseases are carried equally. Yeah. Does he have Mr. Burns disease? Is that what's going on?
They just might not be diseases that exist in his version of Earth. Who knows, right? We'll find out in the
but
TV
that
show.
Was never.
And the gun, the gunslinger, it seemed like it was always mind over matter with him too. You know?
I loved that like, heart thing where it was to shoot a gun, it was his heart, not his head.
Yeah, he just decided
he kills with his heart. Yeah. He shoots with his mind.
Yeah,
right.
And then like the more he went deep into thought, it's like it was kind of like the equivalent of like in wrestling in the old days, you know, Hulk Hogan would be getting punched onto the canvas and then all of a sudden he'd say, okay, this doesn't hurt anymore. This doesn't hurt anymore, you know, like fake wrestling. That was kind of like Idris Elba's, like, okay, he's getting shot at. He can't shoot back. Then all of a sudden he would like give his head a shake or something, and then he'd hear everything and he'd go in this mental space, like, and they didn't really explain what that was. Like,
no,
with Jake, they said it was the shine, but with the gunslinger, it was just like...
Yeah, the gunslingers don't have the shine.
It could be a gene thing. They just... have the ability to do that. They're just like a specific type of species in that version of Earth or something.
Again, I don't disagree, but this is the thing with these fantasy films, though. It's like when you're doing the world building, you have to show us some of the schematics.
Yeah.
You know, it's if, you know, think if you're watching Iron Man and you just see like someone in an iron suit show up and it's like, yeah, I'm Tony Stark, the Iron Man. Okay. How did you get this? Or, you know, Captain America. What if Captain America started, like, you know, the movie started halfway through and you just see this guy with a shield throwing a shield around.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you don't have to worry about anything. I'm just Captain America. That's all you need to know. What? I mean, it's...
MCU knew they were going to be able to do a ton of sequels for them, too.
Again, I understand that. But, you know, the first Captain America movie, the first Thor movie, the first Iron Man movie, all those movies explain to you who this person is, why they can do what they do, and how they do it. And you're still able to enjoy them.
Yeah, they're good as singular films. They're enjoyable, yeah.
So that's just, I would like to know, what is a gunslinger? How do you become a gunslinger? What is the gunslinger's powers? And how is a gunslinger different from any of the regular human? I mean, there's a scene where he like walks in the village, like, they're like, holy crap, it's a gunslinger. It's a gunslinger. I haven't seen a gunslinger in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, why is that important?
Well, I'm more curious about Matthew McConaughey, like how he got those powers. Like, was he born that way? Is there other people like him? Is he the only one with powers?
Exactly.
Yeah. But I like questions. That's the thing, right?
But, yeah, we'll have to wait for the sequel for that one.
If there is a sequel, and it's just – at the same time, though, it's – yeah, Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey, Tom Taylor, great. But it's just like Jackie Earle Haley is in this. Wasted. Catherine Winnick is in this. The mom. Great actress if you ever see her on Vikings. Wasted. Claudia Kim, wasted. Franz Kranz, wasted. Dennis Haysbert, who plays the gunslinger's dad, wasted. And it's just, you know, I don't know how much of this is on the cutting room floor. But there's, I mean, I can't believe they set out to make, we're going to make a slim, quick, easy does it, 90-minute Dark Tower. People will get it, and then they'll come and tune into the TV show.
It's always a bad sign when you have four screenwriters and it took 10 years. So I'm sure there's tons on the cutting room floor. I thought they held it together pretty well for what it was. Because I know you've noticed some details, but they seem to hide whatever details there were pretty well so that it still flowed as a story, I thought. Anyway.
The editor should get an Academy Award. I will admit it holds up even though, you know, you're watching this and you have all these questions. It's a perfectly slick, fine, good hangover movie, I will admit. But it's just, I think I wanted to... I'm obviously not going to dive into these books because they're 1,000 pages long. And we talked about this after the show last week about these huge Stephen King books. And, you know, I can read 4 or 5 books in the time it would take to read a Stephen King book. And what do I want to do more, read 5 books or read 1 book? Okay. But the thing is, I wanted to sort of this movie to show me why these books mean so much to the people who love the books. And I did not get that. And I think that's when you see one of these adaptations, whether it's Harry Potter, whether it's Lord of the Rings, whether it's Twilight, whether it's, you know, the Hunger Games, I think you want to be able to not just translate the material, but translate the passion and show people who aren't familiar with the books why people are passionate about the books. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Stephen King adaptations do that well. Mm-hmm. Some do not. Mm-hmm. But I think Dark Tower is sort of held up as kind of the modern sort of big epic next to Lord of the Rings. And I did not get the Lord of the Rings vibe from this.
Mm. No, me neither.
But it's interesting that Stephen King himself, I think he's on record that he likes this version.
He was helping out with it and apparently liked it at the beginning, but okay. There's rumors that he did leave at a certain point or at least just stopped helping them because he was not into it.
And you can't take his word all the time because like The Shining, he hated that because it went off from his book, right? There was some artistic license in that, to put it mildly. So.
Right. I can't trust King's judgment about his own work because he loves the Steven Weber miniseries, hates the Stanley Kubrick version. Yeah.
Which is baloney.
Yes.
I don't think he likes Shawshank Redemption either.
Again.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think there's a certain difficulty when you're sort of being the novel writer and coming in and adapting your own material. And I think we see that to a certain extent with the Fantastic Beasts movies where J.K. Rowling is writing the screenplay instead of not writing the novel basis for the screenplay. And I think the author of the Divergent movies was involved in the or at least the one latter Divergent series movies, and those movies just got worse as they went along. So it's, you know, it's hard to cast an artistic eye when you're translating your story from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't entirely poo-poo Stephen King's opinions of how his works are translated. That's his opinions. But, I mean, this is a... Movies are a very different thing from the books.
Yeah, it's a different form of media, so they should be made in a different way.
Right. And so I don't mind them going off book for the Dark Tower movie, but still, what I wanted was a movie that made me say, I have to go check out those books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go check out those books.
No, I'm probably not going to.
Or the comics, or the TV show, the future TV show.
Oh, I'll check out that TV show.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. I want to see this world of gunslingers,
right? Yeah, just out of curiosity, I'll watch the first episode.
Well, that's the thing, too. I would love to have seen, like, maybe an elaborate flashback. Like, what does a bunch of gunslingers fighting look like? I mean, we only got the one flashback of the gunslinger and his father. And
that was one of my favorite parts, so I wish that had been longer or they had more flashbacks.
Yeah, I mean, because you see two good actors playing off each other.
Oh, yeah.
I think it stands up by itself. I think they did an okay job technically, but it just I think there were expectations for this movie above because of how long we've been hearing about it, above and beyond what was actually presented. And sometimes I can get over the questions, like it seems like you guys did, but here I just could not get over the questions because when your world, like I said, when you're world building, sometimes you have to show the schematics.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Yeah. So that's I did want to mention one thing. There's a scene with Abby Lee, who's like one of the Men in Black's little, I don't know, henchmen.
Henchmen. That's perfect.
But she comes in. And he's like, I like your face. And then later, like something goes wrong, and he like tortures her because he's ticked off. And it's never explained. Like, what is your relationship to this person? Why should we be like feeling it because you're torturing?
At first, I thought she might be the wife, but then he abuse her, and I start hoping that she's not. I think she was just a helper. Something.
Just yeah, an example slave. Out of her or something.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
So I mean, that's. Okay, I'm done firing Dark Tower. All right. So that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you did like it, you can listen to us again on endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. Tim, if people want to hear more from you, where can they find you online?
Flash in the Deadpan. You can check out the website or you can check me out on Twitter or social media.
And for me, my Twitter is Mr. Talrak. I also just want to quickly say Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond, is a film everyone should see at TIFF. It's about Andy Kaufman and Tom Hardy is going to, sorry, Tony Clifton is going to be in it, and everyone should see it.
Well, cool. There you go. There's a ringing endorsement. And you can find Peter, because he gave you his social media feed, and then you can complain about it when you do see it on his advice.
Go for it.
I will be back on CFRU later today at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph, and that's with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. You can get in touch with me anytime at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or at Adam A. Donaldson on Facebook, and you can find my political blog, Guelph Politico, at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. You can stay tuned to CFRU now for more great programming. This is CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.